Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga, offering warm clothing from Smart Wool, Patagonia, and Fjällräven, including Merino Wool. Located at 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or at rutabagashop.com.
Walk down the street and listen to traffic, cell phones, sirens. What do sounds tell us about our own culture? I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year. How does a musicologist's approach to sounds reveal new ways to look at different events, from the Chernobyl disaster to the space race, the invasion of Ukraine to the World Cup? Joining me to explore sounds and us from Moscow to Madison is UW-Madison Professor of Musicology Gabrielle Cornish, author of Socialist Noise, Sound and Soviet Identity After Stalin, and numerous articles about the link between sound and culture. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've got to ask you about your field of study. Musicology, we think of studying music and musicians, but you're doing a lot of work with sounds that are outside the limits of music. If you're talking about beeping crosswalks and the echoes and traffic sounds and so on, tell us about your field and what made you go into that.
Yeah, it's you know, even musicology is obscure enough of a field that many people aren't familiar with it. I came to musicology from a performance background. In a past life, I was a percussionist who loved making very, very loud sounds, as one can imagine. And when I got to college, I studied music history and Russian studies, and I actually studied abroad in Russia several times, including doing a whole year in between my undergraduate degree and my graduate degree, right on the edge of Siberia. And it was this year in sort of middle of nowhere Siberia. It's actually a large city by American standards, but is still somewhat provincial by Russian standards. It was that year in which I really became exposed to all different types of Russian musical practices, indigenous Siberian musical practices, practices from like Bashkir and Tatar cultures, these ethnic minorities within Russia. And these musical experiences included going to the symphony, where, you know, I had sort of been trained as a percussionist, but also going to hear a Russian Dixieland band, which was quite bizarre, but very, very interesting. And, you know, going to a show in someone's apartment where it was just one person with a couple of microphones and, you know, one synthesizer and just, you know, kind of like making noise as a sort of social practice and as a means of gathering this community. And so when I got back from my year abroad in Russia, I had about 2 months in upstate New York, where I'm originally from, before I went to grad school. And I remember one night, it's July, late July, I think, and I'm walking along this river path from my mother's house to my grandparents' house. It sounds much more picturesque than it actually is, but I could hear, it was very, very quiet, but I could hear the fluorescent lights humming up above me as they lit this path. And I stopped somewhere on the sort of, it was like a 10-minute walk, I think, and I stopped. And I couldn't figure out what was different, what sounded strange, or what had sort of pulled me out of that moment. And it was only after what seemed like an eternity, but was probably in actuality only maybe 30 seconds of listening, that I realized that I was hearing late summer crickets, you know, which everybody mm-hmm. who has grown up in upstate New York and many other places in the United States has heard before. But I didn't hear those crickets when I was in this city, Chelyabinsk, on the edge of Siberia. And it was one of those moments, I think, where something clicked in my head. And I recognized that, you know, I was reflecting on this year I had spent abroad in the very, like, sort of self-indulgent, romanticized way that a 22-year-old who's just had this great adventure might do. And I recognized that sound both placed me in a specific place, this small town in upstate New York, and displaced me from where I had been living for 10 months. And so when I got to graduate school, I started in a musicology program, and I thought that, you know, I would study Tchaikovsky. I loved Tchaikovsky's operas, or maybe some of the 20th century Soviet composers like Prokofiev or Shostakovich. These are the big names mm-hmm. that people who listen to Western art music might be familiar with as coming from that part of the world. And then my first semester, I took a grad methods course that was actually taught by the wonderful scholar who would later become my advisor. And there was a week on something called sound studies. Now, musicology, I had gotten used to the idea that this is looking at the history behind different styles, genres, works of music, looking at the reception of this, taking a sort of critical theoretical approach to music as a social and cultural object. But I'd never heard of something called sound studies. And that week of that grad method seminar sort of blew open my frame of reference for me in a really exciting way, because sound studies takes, you know, I mean, there are many different, we're academics, right? So we're always arguing about what our field actually is, because that's how we publish lots of articles and get tenure. But it expands our frame of reference for what it means to think, to listen rather critically to the world around us. And I would say it takes a more holistic approach to sound. And so some of this intersects with music in interesting ways. So sound studies will oftentimes look at recorded media and the different valences afforded by, say, the gramophone record in its early years, which the phonograph, right, invented for most intents and purposes by Thomas Edison, came out of a desire to create a telephone with Alexander Graham Bell. And so you've got this sort of flow between musical and non-musical worlds in some of these recorded media. But then also this question of how does sound mediate our relationship with the world around us? And much like those crickets had that night in 2014 in upstate New York in the summer, had placed me so firmly in a moment, in a place, and anyone who's heard something and experienced a wave of nostalgia also knows mm-hmm. that sound triggers memories. It changed my perspective and the way that I move through the world.
I can see that, because just thinking of meeting you today and looking at some of the work you've done kind of made me think about sound in a different way. And then as I was walking from where I parked my car to the radio station, I, of course, then heard the sound of construction, the crosswalk beeping and announcing it was now safe to cross because they have accessible, mm-hmm. you know, recordings. There was a car that went by with a radio blaring a song. There's my own footsteps. There's jet overhead, somebody's cell phone. You know, there's all these noises that you hear that I think I would have, if, you know, if I weren't going to talk to you and hadn't thought about it, I just would have tuned all that out as sort of the normal everyday buzz of you know, sound that's around us. Do you ever find that it's almost like a curse, that sure, it's a blessing to be able to hear all these sounds of nature and to be aware of the people talking, the different languages, the technology, but it's almost deafening when you start yeah. to hear everything, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's yes, both a blessing and a curse, you know. And more often than not, I don't follow the advice I give to my students, which is to listen more deeply to the world around them. And when I take, you know, the rapid transit bus line from my home to campus, I have my ear pods in and I'm listening to, you know, podcasts or music or whatever. And I think there's this way in which, especially with mobile media, so starting with the Walkman and up through, you know, the sort of age of Spotify and Apple Music and TikTok, there's this way in which we curate our soundscapes, we curate our sonic environments in a way that we didn't necessarily do 100 years ago while on the move. And so there's this way in which I think, you know, I'm trying to focus myself with music, and I know a lot of my students constantly are listening to music in their headphones, and many of them use it to focus when they're writing or reading. They use it when they're at the gym. They use it, you know, and I go to a gym in East Madison, and they're playing music on speakers in the gym, but I still listen to my own music because I enjoy creating that sort of personal sound bubble. And there's this wonderful scholar, Shohei Hosokawa, who's written about the sort of mobile music revolution and what it means to curate that personal sound bubble. So I think that's maybe a defense mechanism. At the same time, you know, I feel very, very lucky, very privileged that I am able to, because of, you know, the wonderful education that I've gotten from people who cared about these sorts of things, I'm able to interact with my world differently than I would have been able to do 10 years ago, even.
I understand that a background as a percussionist would set you up for that, because so many percussion instruments now use strange sounds and
yes.
tapping and rubbing and scraping. I mean, just all kinds of noise that gets incorporated into compositions. In terms of your choice of Russia, what drew you there? Obviously not the weather if you're headed to Siberia, but why study sound in Russia?
Yeah, it was truly just kind of by chance. Growing up, I had listened to my grandparents dragged me, I think quite literally kicking and screaming at one point, to a local orchestra concert. And again, you know, relatively small orchestra in upstate New York, where they played a piece by the Russian composer Sergei Rachmaninoff, his third piano concerto, which is a wonderful piece. But I wasn't musical. You know, I just wanted to play soccer and hang out with friends. I was in, I think, sixth grade. But something clicked for me when I saw that piece and heard that piece, just the sort of programmatic narrative that piano concerto could tell. And I remember flipping through the program notes for this Philharmonic orchestra for the rest of their season. And the next week, they were doing Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony, which is infamous for its political connotations. And is this Shostakovich, you know, defying Stalin secretly? Is this Shostakovich reiterating the importance of the Soviet socialist realist dream? Things like that. And I was, you know, a maybe 12-year-old who had a rebellious streak. And I liked the idea of, you know, a composer maybe sticking it to the authorities through music. And so I made my grandparents take me back. And then the next day I signed up for middle school band as a percussionist. And so that interest in Eastern European and Soviet music especially was really mm-hmm. there from the beginning of my musical career, where, you know, we were squawking out horrible things on half-sized instruments. And anyone who's got a child in middle school band knows that sound. And so when I got to college, a few of my friends had taken a Russian language class with this wonderful professor. And I had sort of sworn off languages. I didn't think I was particularly good at languages. But they convinced me the next year. They said, no, you have to take a class with this professor. He's wonderful. You'll love it. And so I signed up, and I did love it. And it seemed like for the first time I was able to develop this broader cultural understanding of this music, Rachmaninoff, Shostakovich, that had shaped me from such a young age. And then I think just through the sort of fortunes of finding good professors and mentors, I ended up majoring in Russian studies. And, you know, these study abroad experiences really, again, brought together my two interests. I have no Slavic heritage. I have no Slavic background. But it felt very much like an adventure. And this was back in, you know, I graduated college in 2013. And so it was an adventure that still felt ripe with possibility for what Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union could be. And that sense of adventure, of possibility, of new frontiers really appealed to me. I'd never left the country, say, for maybe a walk to Niagara Falls from the U.S. side to Canada before I went to Russia for the first time. And so
So the world opens up, including the world of sound. We're calling this hour Sounds and Us from Moscow to Madison. So let's talk about the sounds of Moscow. One of the clips that you shared with me that we can hear a little bit from is from a film A Walk Around Moscow, a 1964 film. Can you tell us about why you think that clip is worth listening to, what we should hear, and then we'll hear a little bit of it?
Yeah, so I love this clip, and I oftentimes teach it to students when I'm introducing them to sound studies because it's a musical clip. The story of this film, very simply, is that a young man moves from a more rural setting in the Soviet Union to Moscow, this huge metropolis, you know, 12, 13 million people. And it's sort of, you know, it's culture shock for him. But by the end of the film, he's got a sort of rapscallion personality. By the end of the film, he's really fully immersed himself in Moscow culture. And this film in 1964 is released at this time in Soviet history known as the Thaw, which begins, rather, right after Stalin dies in 1953. Nikita Khrushchev comes to power and in 1956 denounces the Stalinist repressions and opens up these cultural vistas. And so Soviet censorship, for example, of writing, music, art, is very much loosened. And composers and artists are able to experiment with new techniques in ways that they weren't encouraged to do so, or at worst, actively punished for doing so under the Stalinist regime. And so there's this sense of pervasive hope during the thaw that eventually peters out by the end of the 60s. Khrushchev leaves office in 1964. And then in 1968, you see the Soviets crushing protest movements in the Eastern Bloc, and that kind of marks the conventional end. So this film falls right at this moment of endless hope and optimism and possibility. And this clip that I've sent ahead to you that we'll listen to some of is at the very end of this film, and this young man is walking through the Moscow metro, which if anyone has ever been to Moscow, or there are many, many metro systems in the former Soviet Union that are gilded and beautiful, and the Moscow metro was very much a sort of the projection of Soviet power. And so he's walking through this metro and he's singing this song about, you know, I'm walking around Moscow, life is good, I'm very carefree, what a great place to be. And you can actually hear in the musical score some of the chimes that you would hear when the Moscow doors are closing. Right. So there's a way in which the composer's incorporating the sound of this city into this song about the city.
And I assume these are not recorded sounds, but instruments imitating the sounds?
Yes, yes. The composer uses, I think, the vibraphone and the glockenspiel, or the bells, to tap out this three-note, three-pitch pattern that would be playing if the doors closed or when the train arrives. And then about a minute into this clip, as the young man is getting ready to sort of go up the escalators, and the subways in Moscow are very, very deep, and so it's a very long escalator ride, he's stopped by a woman who's ostensibly a sort of security guard, who says, you know, young man, why are you shouting? And she knocks him out of this musical moment. He says, I'm not shouting, I'm singing. And she goes... She says, okay, sing away, continue. And he then continues the song. And so again, there's this way in which this moment is bringing the sounds of Moscow into contact, into dialogue with this musical score that I think shows that the borders that we trace between music and sound are far more porous than we actually give them credit for.
Let's hear a little bit of that.
Сразу не поймешь, а просто летний дождь прошел, нормальный летний дождь, мелькнет в толпе знакомое лицо, веселые глаза, а в них бежит садовое кольцо, а в них блестит садовое кольцо и летняя гроза. А я иду, шагаю по Москве, но в жизни я пройти смогу.
Молодой человек! Ты чё кричишь?
Я пою.
Гражданин!
Что?
Иди сюда.
Зачем?
Иди-ка, иди-ка. Что?
Спой еще.
Да ну.
А я иду, шагаю по Москве, но я пройти еще смогу.
That's a sample of the sounds of Moscow from the 1964 film A Walk Around Moscow. We'll be back in a moment with more University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with my guest, Gabrielle Cornish, and we are talking about sounds and us from Moscow to Madison. We have a musicologist who records sounds, listens to sounds, studies music, and takes a look at what we can learn about ourselves and others through studying sound. So from Moscow, and we heard a clip from a movie where there's the sound of a security guard and there's singing, exchanges of conversation, different imitations of sounds of the trains. You find yourself then in Russia and are studying different musicians, different sounds. What kinds of, I noticed in one thing you wrote that socialism sounds different than capitalism. And I was trying to figure out, because those two isms, you know, socialism and capitalism are, it's hard for me to figure out what kind of specifics you have in mind when you say it sounds different.
Yeah, or rather, it's not necessarily me who is saying that it sounds different, but the Soviets believed very, very strongly that socialism needed to sound different from capitalism. So the bulk of my research takes place during the Cold War, where you have this ideological struggle between capitalism in North America and Western Europe and socialism predominantly in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. And this is playing out especially in the non-aligned world. So many countries on the continent of Africa at this time are decolonizing. And both the Soviets and the Americans are swooping in to try to present their ideological, political, and economic system as being the superior one. And part of that, as cultivated at the highest levels of the Soviet government, is a desire to prove that Soviet socialism sounded different and ultimately sounded better than American capitalism. And so, for example, the Soviet Union is the first country in the world to institute noise abatement legislation at a federal level, because they take very, very seriously that they have a duty to protect the health of the worker and the health of the citizen. Part of this is linked to productivity. If a worker is not getting a full night's sleep because his neighbor is up banging on pots and pans, then he will be less efficient and effective at work. But they present this as an alternative to Western capitalism that, in their eyes, and I think there's some truth in this, glorifies constant work, constant labor, constant hustle. And so the idea of, say, New York City being the city that never sleeps. Well, the Soviets say, we need sleep. Sleep keeps us healthy.
So there should be more silence.
So there should be more silence and more noise regulations. And so some of these changes that they make are minute. Things like changing milk delivery cans that used to be delivered to stores in these giant metal milk jugs. You know, we're in Wisconsin, so I'm assuming that plenty of our listeners have encountered these large milk jugs before. They changed that from metal to plastic, because when dairy farmers drop these off early in the morning, the metal clangs. You drop it on the sidewalk, it's loud. The plastic doesn't clang in the same way. And so there are these tiny changes, things like architects figuring out where best to place elevators and trash chutes in the building, so that if somebody drops, you know, a bunch of cans down the trash chute at 1 a.m., it's not going to wake people up. Now, of course, in the United States at the same time, there are efforts to do this as well, but it's happening on a more localized level than it is in the Soviet Union by virtue of having a more centralized political system.
What else sounds different? I mean, if you recorded something during the Cold War at a time, you know, in the Soviet Union, what would sound different other than perhaps less noise?
Well, even then, I don't think the Soviets were always successful in noise mitigation attempts. In their mind, in the minds of these bureaucrats, they sound drastically different. I think if you were to take a field recording from the center of Moscow in 1965 and compare it to a field recording from the center of New York City from 1965, save for the languages being spoken, I don't think that the average person would be able to hear much of a difference. There are some things that are very unique to place. So, for example, in the Soviet Union, because this is a centralized economic and political system, they do things like design prefabricated apartment buildings in the late 50s into the 60s. These are four-story apartment buildings that oftentimes looked very, very similar, whether you were in Tashkent or Riga or Moscow or Siberia. And they were, again, about four or five stories and often enclosed in your inner courtyard. And so if I see one of these in a film about whatever, right, where it's showing some sort of through the American gaze, Eastern Europe, I instantly know, okay, that is a Khrushchevka, these buildings that were built during the Khrushchev era. And when you're inside that courtyard, the acoustics of that space sound very, very distinct because you've got these high walls and you've got people who have their windows open from all sides. You've got children often playing in some sort of playground in the middle of that. And so there's this way in which there are some normal things that would stick out to someone who grew up in that context. Again, had I, going back to the first segment, not grown up in upstate New York, I don't know if I would have noticed the crickets as being different from where I'd spent that year on the edge of Siberia. So, of course, there are what some scholars call sound marks, sonic landmarks. So the bells of the Moscow metro that we heard in the previous example is one. Whereas in New York City, the metro, the subway system has a different but still distinct sound. Where I went to college, the Carillon, the bell tower, was very, very prominent, and it was a smaller college, and so you could always hear it, and it chimed every 15 minutes. And so when I hear those sounds, that places me back, you know, as a doe-eyed 19-year-old figuring out what music was for the first time. And so everywhere you go, you'll have some distinctive sounds. But I think truly, the fact that the Soviets felt this so strongly, but in practice, socialism did not necessarily sound different from capitalism. That's, I think, where, as a scholar, that's where I think the most interesting part of this lies. Because the ways that we imagine sound don't always correlate with the actual acoustical properties of sound. Sound at its core is vibration, right? I sometimes, just to provoke students, when I'm speaking to them, I say, oh, I was just touching your ears. Because there's this way in which the sounds I emit vibrate and make contact, make physical contact with these students' ears. We right now are in an acoustically sound recording booth where there is very little echo and reverb, right? And so there's sound as an acoustical property, as a physical property. But then there's sound as something that we experience as a cultural phenomenon. There's sound as a sort of metaphor that we use, right? Oh, that, what do you want for dinner tonight? I want chicken. That sounds great. Mm-hmm. The chicken itself doesn't sound great. I mean, hopefully not. I'm not killing a live chicken for dinner. Hopefully, you know, I've gotten this from Woodman's and it's already, you know, ready to cook. There's sound in the way that we use noise as a sort of pejorative. So when I listen to some of the music that I love, if I'm, say, you know, back at my mom's house and I'm listening to something, she'll come in and she'll say, would you turn off that noise? It's not music. She doesn't like it. It's not music. It's noise, right? And we see this throughout history. Take, for example, in the 1970s and the 1980s, when hip-hop starts becoming a prominent genre, and you've got people who are driving through, you mentioned listening to a car playing music on your commute this morning, you've got people who are driving through predominantly white suburbs outside of the city, and they're playing hip-hop music, and people, predominantly white people, are complaining to local police officers and trying to institute noise abatement regulations for their small community because, well, that's not music, that's just noise. And so the ways that we deploy these categories are very, very interesting to me. And so when the Soviets are saying, we feel very strongly that socialism has to be less noisy than capitalism, it's not really that the acoustical properties of socialism, which on its own does not have an acoustical value, it's not really that the acoustical properties are different. It's that sound and noise as a metaphor for all of these other political and philosophical ideologies and battles between the Soviet Union and the United States during the Cold War. Sound is this really useful metaphor in their eyes and ears at the highest levels of the Soviet government.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I see that one of the clips that you have is a recording you did in 2018 on a walk through Red Square during the 2018 World Cup. You know, what is it that you thought was worth recording, and we'll hear a little bit of it. What is it that you recorded and that you found significant?
Yeah, so I was in Moscow for a year doing my dissertation research. And I'm a big soccer fan, and the World Cup that year was held in Russia, in various cities across Russia. And so it was a very, very exciting time. I didn't actually get to see any of the games live. The tickets were more than a young graduate student could afford. But just walking through the city of Moscow, you saw fans from all over the world. All over the world. And you could identify them initially by, okay, are they wearing yellow, green, and blue jerseys? Okay, they must be fans of Brazil, right? Are they wearing red and white jerseys? They must be supporting perhaps Poland, right? But you could also hear these differences. So there were the linguistic cues that Moscow had almost overnight become this incredibly diverse and international city where I could walk down the street and whereas normally, I would only hear Russian being spoken or predominantly Russian and maybe languages from former Soviet republics like Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan being spoken. I could walk down the street and I could hear English, I could hear German, I could hear French, I could hear Portuguese. And so that to me was so fascinating that Moscow and many of these other cities that were World Cup hosts in Russia had become epicenters for international cultural exchange. And so I remember one day walking through Red Square, and this is the famous shot that everybody sees in their high school history textbooks of Russia, where you've got Lenin's mausoleum where his embalmed body is still on display. On one side, you've got the brick walls of the Kremlin, you have the onion domes of St. Basil's Cathedral. And I remember walking through Red Square and just being struck by all of these different sounds and chants and songs that people were singing and making, where I could walk past a group of fans from Mexico who were singing, you know, ole, 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 ole. I'm not a singer, so, you know, apologies to whoever has to listen to that. And then you could walk another 15 feet and you would hear fans from Poland chanting about their star player, Robert Lewandowski. And this collision of sounds was so fascinating. And then people started joining in with groups from other countries and other fan bases. And so these Polish fans were approached by a few people who were sporting Mexico jerseys, one of whom had a sombrero on. And I don't think that these fans of Mexico, of the Mexican team, necessarily spoke Polish. But through some of the more onomatopoeic elements of soccer chants, like that ole, they were able to join in chorus with fans from all around the world. So sonically, as a soccer fan, it was very, very interesting. But I think, too, it represented this particular moment in Russian politics where Vladimir Putin's regime was very, very concerned with presenting Russia, similar to how the Soviets had been thinking about international and cultural exchange 50 years earlier, but this idea that they could present Russia as a forward-thinking, modern, international, cosmopolitan nation, which, of course, at the time, Russia had still been occupying illegally annexed Crimea in Ukraine, and only 4 years later would begin the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. But so this idea that suddenly all of these sounds that otherwise might not have been particularly, they wouldn't have been actively repressed, but it wouldn't have been welcomed quite in the same way. These sounds became a marker for the Putin regime and for many just ordinary Muscovites of progress that Russia had made since the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Let's hear a little bit from the Red Square in 2018 at the time of the World Cup.
Robert Lewandowski!
As we're listening to that, the different voices, are you also hearing a different kind of acoustic because it's in Red Square with a particular architecture? Is it cobblestones?
Yeah.
How does the space affect the sound we just heard?
Dramatically. So Red Square is quite large. It's certainly the first time I walked out onto Red Square when I was first studying abroad in Russia. I was struck by how huge the space is, because again, it's one of those things that you see in textbooks, but you don't really experience until you get there. My spatial reasoning is probably not good enough to actually estimate just how big it is. But on one side of Red Square, you've got this famous shopping mall that existed. It existed during the Soviet era, and now, rather than sort of being able to buy mostly domestic goods, you've got Prada, you've got Gucci, you've got all of these luxury brands. And this is probably about a four-story high, very, very long. It traverses almost the entire length of one side of Red Square with old bricks and stones on one side. And on the other side, you have the walls of the Kremlin, which are red brick, very, very tall. And so there's this sort of cross... This way in which the sound bounces from wall to wall from one direction. And then also it's much longer than it is wide, Red Square. And so you've got St. Basil's Cathedral with the onion domes on one side. And then you have another smaller building on the other, the opposite side. And so there's this way in which all of those stones are very acoustically live, right? Think about if you're in, say, a high school gymnasium and you bounce a ball or you say something, you can hear that echo, that space, versus where we are now in this smaller recording studio where the noise tends to be a bit more what we might call dead because we have these sound panels on the walls that deaden that echo. And so absolutely the space of Red Square, because it's so expansive, is shaping how anyone moving throughout there is hearing their surroundings. And I think also it's shaping how people are sonically intruding in that space. So if I'm in a small room like this, I'm probably not going to be shouting at the top of my lungs. But if I'm on Red Square and I've got, you know, five other fans and we're all shouting praises for our star soccer striker, well, that space is so resonant that it's very exciting to get that feedback, to hear that echo and that resonance. So I think it changes the ways that people actually interact with that space as well.
Because of your work with Russia and sound, when you were back and the invasion of Ukraine happened in February 2022, you started writing quite a bit about sound and music in Ukraine, including in the New York Times and elsewhere. Tell us about your thoughts on music, sound in Ukraine.
Yeah. I think, like many people who study Eastern Europe, when the Russians began the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of 22, it was horrifying for so many reasons. I mean, it's horrifying for I think everyone to see that kind of violence perpetuated against a sovereign nation. But as someone who had friends in both Russia and Ukraine, who I'd made through these years of traveling throughout that region and speaking Russian well enough that I could read some Ukrainian. I speak Ukrainian with a pretty thick Russian accent, which is not always politically expedient these days, nor, you know, frankly, politically polite, because it speaks to the sort of imperialized context that Russian has taken on in U.S. academia. It was particularly horrifying. And so the first month, probably, of the full-scale invasion, I spent most of that time just checking in with friends in both countries to make sure that they were safe. And most of my closest Russian friends have left Russia because they do not support the Putinist regime and did not want to be conscripted and sent to the front to fight an illegal war. And fortunately, the vast majority of my Ukrainian friends were also able to get out, and they're now refugees in mostly Western Europe, Western and Central Europe. And so once the initial shock had sort of worn down, I thought, okay, I have this skill set where I've spent the last 10 years of my life, 10 plus years of my life, learning more about this region, learning the language, traveling around. Is there some way that I can feel useful in this moment when there's this mass emergency and it seems like you want to do something to help, but you can't figure out? And I was living in Miami, Florida at the time, so I was not going to be able to hop on a train and get to Kyiv to start, you know, cooking for refugees or things like that. And I had been watching all of these different clips coming out through social media and, you know, platforms like Twitter, and was struck by how even in these horrific early moments of the full-scale invasion, people were using music as a balm. B-A-L-M, a balm. It's important to specify. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I shared with you today two clips, one, both of the Ukrainian national anthem, one being sung and or played, rather, on a sort of ragtag group of musical instruments by these Ukrainian soldiers who were based in, at this point, Donetsk, which was, you know, quickly then subsumed under Russian occupation and controlled by the Russian military. But these Ukrainian soldiers are standing around this massive crater and they're playing the Ukrainian national anthem. And to me, there's the sonic aspect beyond just the acoustics, because there's nobody else in this large courtyard because people have been evacuated, and you can hear their instruments echoing off the walls. But there's also that political element and that question of, you know, what is this music doing here? And I think for those Ukrainian soldiers who were playing it, it was very much a sort of act of resistance. And there's only so much music can do in terms of resisting, right? But I think for them in that moment, it was a way of asserting their presence sonically in that damaged region.
We're going to listen to that when we return in a moment with University of the Year. That's a Ukrainian national anthem, and it's a group of Ukrainian military service members playing it as they stand around a bombed-out crater. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with my guest, Gabrielle Cornish, and we are talking about The Sound of Us from Moscow to Madison. With that anthem, you also had another clip of the same anthem, but in a very different place and time. Can you tell us about that, and we'll listen to that?
Yeah. So right around the same time that I stumbled across this video of these Ukrainian soldiers playing their national anthem, I saw another video of protesters in Moscow, anti-war protesters, who were being very violently hauled into ostensibly paddy wagons by the police and security services in Moscow after they had been protesting. And there's a man who, as he's being hauled into this paddy wagon, starts singing somewhat discordantly at the top of his lungs the Ukrainian national anthem. And so I was really struck by how, in two different settings, this anthem took on such different resonances, where for the Ukrainian soldiers in Donetsk, it's a symbol of resilience, of survival, of perseverance. And in the Russian context, as this man is being dragged off to jail for protesting against the war, it's this method of resistance and this method of solidarity, really. And so I found that very, very moving in many ways. And yeah, I think just really spoke to the emotional complexities of that moment.
So obviously music and sound, you know, they're political and they come with all kinds of messages and power. In the short time that we have left, I wonder if you can help all of our listeners get some sense of what to listen to and what kinds of sounds to pay attention to, and maybe some of the exciting things with all the new technology that's out there that composers might be doing that will change how we hear things.
Yeah. Well, so in preparation for this interview, I did a field recording of my commute from the east side of Madison to campus yesterday. And I thought it was really fascinating to be on the bus with a field recorder, because the microphone changes how people around you react. Some people on the bus got very, very quiet, as if I were recording their secret conversations. Others looked at me in sort of a strange way. I wouldn't have been surprised if somebody had actually come up to me and asked, what are you doing with a microphone, right? So there's this way in which it makes its presence very, very known, even just from a visual standpoint. But as I'm recording the sounds of this bus, or the sounds of my walk from my house to my bus, I'm paying attention to how, when you pull the cable to signal to the bus driver that you want to get off at the next stop, you hear this little chirp, right? And then maybe depending on the bus you're actually riding on, you'll hear, you know, next stop is Baldwin Street. So there's that. Also thinking about the cars as they drive past me, right? Thinking about, you know, okay, this is East Washington. It's a busier street versus my street, which is much quieter, right? And so there's all of this information that you're gathering constantly when you just go about your day.
Plus the weather with the drizzle coming down.
The weather, the drizzle, and of course all of that moisture changes the acoustic properties of the space as well. You know, the electric buses are almost silent if they're at a standstill, whereas the old gas buses would still be pretty noisy. And so there's all of this information that we're collecting constantly. And some scholars of sound studies suggest that there's an important difference between hearing and listening, where hearing is much more passive, right? Hearing is something that is acted upon me, whereas listening, much like looking at something, is me focusing my ears on the sound around you. And there's some problems with that dichotomy, but I think at its core, it speaks to this idea that we can choose to tune these sounds out, much like how visually we're only processing so much information at a time. But if we stop and make a mindful attempt to listen, the landscape around us changes in the same way that sometimes I'll be walking down around the Capitol and I'll look up and I'll recognize some you know, detail on a building that I've never noticed before. Maybe the sun is hitting it in just the right way, and so it pops out to me in that moment when I'd walked that path so many times, right? It's kind of impressionistic in that sense. The same is true of sound, and it changes how you appreciate the space around you and how it can be really useful to slow down a little bit. We get so caught up with the hustle and bustle of every day where, you know, I'm listening to podcasts on my commute because I don't have time to listen to them when I'm just sitting at home with my dog, because that's when I need to be doing all of these other things. Stopping, taking out your ear pods, taking off your headphones, slows you down in a way that I think ultimately gives you a greater appreciation of the diversity of sounds and sights and everything around you.
I think we're going to go out on a piece by a composer that you say is a good example of the use of sound. This would be from Meredith Monk. Can you say something about it? And we'll go out on a little bit of her work, Songs of Ascension.
Sure. So there are a lot of composers, much like that original example that we listened to from I Walk Around Moscow, that film, who are incorporating the sounds of everyday life into their music. But there are also composers who are making, who are experimenting with and playing with the acoustic spaces around them. The most famous of whom is probably, in my mind at least, Pauline Oliveros, who pioneered this practice of deep listening. So again, this idea that performance can simply be the space around you, or she would bring singers into these deep cisterns and have them sing. And even today, there are choirs, especially in bigger cities like New York or Chicago, that will have rehearsals in parking garages, for example, because the acoustics are so different and it changes how you listen. And so I sent along this clip from the composer Meredith Monk. She's an American composer based predominantly in New York City. Because she composed this piece for voices and instruments to be initially performed in a concert hall, but then she collaborated with a sculptor, a visual artist, to create basically a 4 or 5, I think, story spiral winding tower where the stairs are on the inside of this tower. And she has the piece performed there. And it sounds so dramatically different from the like heavily curated acoustics of a concert hall. But it's also clear that these musicians are playing with this space around them, and it changes how they're listening to each other. There's no conductor like you would see in, say, if you're watching a symphony. They're really listening to and reacting to that space in a way that I find really interesting and really illustrative of how many composers now, and again, I've been talking about how this border between sound and noise and music is porous and mobile. These composers are attuned to that as well. So,
and thank you for sharing your work on sound with us. My guest has been Gabrielle Cornish. This is Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next episode of University of the Ear. And here is a little bit of Meredith Monk.